This week's parsha is Parshas Korach. And Parshas Korach, we learn about a great rebellion that took place in the desert. Korach was a Levi. He was from the important Ochashev people from the tribe of Levi. He had the highest post amongst the Levium. He was in charge of actually carrying the Aron, the Ark itself. That's how, what an important position he had amongst the Levites. Korach, however, was not happy with his position. And as Rashi says to us, he wanted a greater position. And he wanted to become the Nasi. He wanted to be the actual prince of his tribe. He wanted to be the leader of the tribe. And Moshe Rabbeinu gave it to his cousin, his younger cousin, whose name was Elitzafan ben Uziel. And Korach, therefore, was unhappy. And therefore, he staged a rebellion against Moshe. And he gathered a whole group of people, and he accused Moshe Rabbeinu for doing things on his own, not by God's direction. And he said that Moshe Rabbeinu is setting up the leadership based on what's good for him. He has appointed his brother Aaron to be the high priest. He has honored the role of the king. His brother Aaron has been appointed as the high priest. And me, Korach, he just pushed me to the side. He couldn't say that. So he just said it's not fair that they have taken all the positions of leadership just for the family, and they haven't been giving it to anybody else. This is just Moshe Rabbeinu doing this on his own. He managed to rally up a big group of people to join him in this rebellion. 250 members. They weren't regular people. These were from the great Talmid HaChamim, the great scholars. These were the, Rashi says, Rashi Sanhedrin, they were the head of the courts. They were great men, and they joined in this rebellion, and it was not a good situation. Again, this was a personal attack against Moshe. So what happens is, Moshe Rabbeinu tries initially to make peace with them, makes an effort, tries to reconcile, calls for peace, but they don't want to hear from it. And Moshe warns them what is going to happen. Moshe said, you know, you want to be a Kohen, I'd also like to be a Kohen, but it was by divine instruction that my brother Aaron should be a Kohen. And he said, listen here, if you think that you are worthy to be Kohanim, then tomorrow we're going to make a test. Everybody should, whoever is volunteering, whoever is requesting this honor of being the high priest, should all line up, and tomorrow we're going to offer ketores, incense, and we're going to bring it in front of the Beis HaMikdash. And he warned them, and he said, you know what happened when you bring a ketores that is not called for? Everybody saw what happened on the day that Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, brought there, and they died. So this is very dangerous. He says, the only one who is really appointed by God, that's the only one who's going to survive. Everyone else is going to die. In the end, of course, a terrible tragedy struck. These 250 men all died. Korach and his family and some of the other bigger troublemakers were swallowed up by the earth. The earth opened up and swallowed them alive. This is the story told to us this week in the parsha. Obviously, we should delve a little deeper. First of all, to understand the lesson to us from this story, but more so to have an understanding in Korach. What exactly was this Korach character all about? Because what we see from the sage is that Korach was a great man. I mean, he would have not been the Nosei Aron. He wouldn't have been the one who has been appointed by God to be carrying the Ark, the Aron itself, when there were so many other candidates for that, had he not been a very great, great person. He actually was the father and the great-great-grandfather of very, very great tzaddikim. Samuel, Shmuel HaNavi, was from his descendants. And in a sense, that's why it says that Korach had Ruach HaKodesh. He was able to look in the future, see his great descendant, and Shmuel was as great as Moshe and Aaron. It says that Shmuel HaNavi, in some ways, was even superior to Moshe and Aaron combined together. Moshe v'Aaron b'Kohanov, we say Friday night. Moshe Aaron in his Kohanov, in his priestlyhood. Yishmuel b'Korach Shmo, Shmuel that calls out in God's name, is equal to them. So Korach felt, because of that, that he was equal to Moshe and Aaron, and therefore he can challenge Moshe and Aaron. So we have to say that there was some deeper meaning in Korach's challenge. It wasn't just that he was a jealous or that he was seeking more honor and more power. There probably was a philosophy, an ideology that Korach believed in, and because of that, he challenged the priestlyhood, the kohun of Aaron. So what is it that Korach wanted? So the mystics tell us something very interesting. They tell us that Korach wasn't that wrong. Korach was only a little too early. Korach had a vision. Korach saw the perfect world. Korach saw and understood something, a truth that belongs to the Messianic days. And he demanded that he should be the Kohen Gadol, or that the Levites should be, he as a Levi should be superior to Aaron, because in a sense, the Levites are really higher than the Kohanim. We know that there is one tribe amongst the Jewish people that was set aside, and they have a role to play above the rest of the Jewish people, a unique role, and that is the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi, however, has two families. There is the family of Levi itself, and then there is the portion of Levi, which was separated not just to be Kodesh, but to be Kodesh Kadashim, to be Holy of Holies. And that is the family of Aaron, the high priest, the Kohanim. In the world that we are living today, the Kohanim are superior to the Levim. The Kohanim are as we know, as we saw, we learned a few weeks ago in the Parsha, when they were purifying the Levim and appointing the Levim to their posts, the verse says that the Levim should be nilvim, they should be go along, they should accompany Aaron, v'yishar sucha. They are attendants to the Kohanim. They are a support crew to the Kohanim. The Kohanim are in charge of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple. The Kohanim are the ones that officiate in the temple. They're the ones who do the main services. And the Levim are in charge of making sure that everything runs smoothly. They're guarding the Beis HaMikdash. They accompany the Kohanim with music and with song. So they're like the support team to the Kohanim, which means that they are higher than the rest of the Jewish people, but they are still inferior to the Kohanim. That is the way it is today. However, the Kabbalists tell us, the Arizal derives it from a pasuk, that when Moshiach will come, the Levim will be greater than the Kohanim. And the Levim will assume the highest level, the highest role, and the Kohanim will be secondary to the Levim. Parenthetically, I have to say this because I'm a Kohen, and when I found this, I was very, very happy, that it doesn't mean that the Levim are going to just shove the Kohanim to the side and start working in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Kohanim are going to have a secondary role. What it means is that when Mashiach comes, the souls that are now the souls of Levim, whatever, are going to be incarnated in Kohanim bodies, which means they're going to be born as Kohanim. It doesn't mean that the Torah is going to change. The Torah set, where one of the principles of the Torah, the Torah is not going to change. So you can't just come along and say, well, Kabbalistically, the Levim are higher than the Kohanim, so they should work in the temple. The Torah says that to work in the temple, you have to be a Kohen. And that is going to apply in the third Beis HaMikdash, as it did in the second Beis HaMikdash and in the first Beis HaMikdash. It only means that neshamis of Levim are going to come down in this world as Kohanim. And they're going to be the Kohanim, which really means that Shevet, that the Levim are going to be Kohanim. Even though to our eyes, it's just going to be Kohanim. But it's really going to be the tribe of Levim. It's going to be a switch, an internal switch, but not an external switch. And in terms of the body, it's still going to be the bodies of Kohanim, meaning it's going to be people that are born to a Kohen, but they're going to be souls of Levim. This is the idea. This is a Kabbalistic idea expounded by the Arizal of how Levim are going to be higher than the Kohanim. And it was for that reason that Korach was demanding that he should be a Kohen, he should be higher than his cousin Aaron, because he was a Levi and Aaron was only a Kohanim. We also see in the genealogy, we see that the Kohanim come from the Levim. Now, first you had Levi, and from his descendants come the Kohanim, which means that if the Kohanim come from the Levim, what does that mean? That means that Levi is higher than Kohen, and that's why the root of the Kohen is from the Levi, so the Levi is superior to the Kohen. We also see what is really the idea behind this. Why are Levim going to be superior to Kohanim when Mashiach comes? That is because of the dynamics of Kohen and Levi. In terms of the spiritual energy of Kohen and Levi, the dynamics of their souls, there are two powers that dominate in existence in the worlds. There is the power of Chesed and there is the power of Gevura. The power of Chesed means kindness, and the power of Gevura, which means discipline and severity and strength. In our world that today, we're living in a Chesed-dominating world, where Chesed dominates Gevura. Chesed comes first. First is Chesed, and then is Gevura. And today's days, the Gevura needs to be subservient to the Chesed. Gvura always has to be subdued to kindness. In the world of Mashiach, there is going to be the root and the source of Gevurah is going to be revealed. And in its source, and its quintessential source, the source of Gevurah, the source of strength and of might, is higher than that of Chesed. And that's why when Mashiach comes, the order of the way it's going to be is Levi is going to be higher than Kohen. Because Kohanim are rooted in Chesed. That's why Kohanim are souls that bless the Jewish people. Kohanim give bracha, because Chesed is blessing, drawing down. And the Levim are Gevura. We see it from many elements of the Levim, that there is an element of that Gevurim, that the Levi, the Levites were, their soul character is from Gevura. In today's world, in the world until Mashiach comes, Chesed is superior to Gevura. Revelation is superior to concealment. And therefore, light is greater than darkness. And therefore, the Levim need to be subservient to the Kohanim. The Kohanim play a higher role, and the Levim are just a support for the Kohanim. When Mashiach is going to will come, there is going to be a revelation of something very deep, as we're going to discuss soon. There is going to be a revelation of the real depth or the real meaning of what Gevurah really means. And therefore, in that world, the Levites are going to be higher than the Kohanim. And that's where we also find another interesting thing about that. We know that there are two schools of thought in regards to halacha. And that is the halacha of Beis Hillel, and there is of Shammai. And we know generally that Shammai is very strict and stringent. And Beis Hillel is much far more lenient. In most of the arguments, Beis Hillel is mekel, and Beis Shammai is machmer. And the reason it says that why Beis Hillel is mekel, Beis Hillel meaning is lenient, and Beis Shammai is machmer, has to do with the energy and the makeup of their souls. The souls of Beis Hillel were from the side of Chesed, and the soul of Shammai and his people were from the side of Gevurah. That is, and being that, again, all godly flow comes through the channels of Chesed and Gevurah, that's why the Torah also flows through these channels of Hillel and Shammai, which are the Chesed and the Gevurah element. It's hinted to actually in their names. Shammai comes from the word to be, there's a pasuk that says, Hasam Erchoysav, meaning someone who is very meticulous in his ways. Shammai also comes from the word Shuma. Shuma means to evaluate and to measure. In Shammai was a man of measurement, everything of strict measurement. That's the nature and the character of his soul. That's why he was very strict. Hillel comes from the word shining. Behilo neri, when my light will shine. Lahalel means to reveal and to shine. So therefore, Hillel's souls were from the souls of kindness, where things shine and there's great revelation. Shammai is from the world of great constriction and concealment, of discipline and the like. In today's world, as we mentioned earlier, Chesed dominates over Gevurah. That's why the halacha is like Beis Hillel and the halacha is not like Beis Shammai. In translating that into actual halacha, where do we see that Hillel is kind? First of all, they're kind to us and give us a little bit more of an easier life when it comes to certain expectations in Yiddishkeit, but something much deeper than that. Hillel is kind to the sparks of holiness. When we say something is permitted based on, in halacha, it means that we're able to draw that element, that spark that is within that food or within that object, and integrate it and bring it back to Hashem. Sometimes Shammai, on the other hand, might be tougher. They'll say that spark cannot return back to its place. They're stricter, they're higher, they're more demanding. So there's an element we might say of cruelty. It's not a cruelty, but it's just more demanding and higher expectations. So here you see again that Shammai is Gevura and Hillel is Chesed. In today's world, the halacha is like Beis Hillel. When Mashiach will come, it says from the Arizal, that the halacha is going to be like Shammai. Because again, when Mashiach comes, the world is going to be, Gevurah is going to be higher than Chesed, and the Levites are going to be higher than the Kohanim. That is the reason why Korach was demanding that the Levim should be superior to the Kohanim, because Korach glimpsed the future world, and he wanted that. What Korach didn't realize, that the only way we will be able to come to a state where the Gevurah is higher than the Chesed, and the Gevurah is superior to Chesed, is only if the Gevurah is subservient to the Chesed for the first, until Mashiach comes. In other words, if we do our work today by surrendering the Gevurah, by harnessing the Gevurah to be supporting of Chesed, then when Mashiach will come, the Gevurah will be able to assert itself on its own and be superior. But if we do not do that, and we try to get Gevurah to be subservient today, we can create a horrible mess. To understand this a little better, understand Korach's mistake, and what does all of this mean? So it's interesting that the words that the parsha begins with are with the words Vayikach Korach, and Korach took. The Targum on the words Vayikach Korach, the Targum says, he translates, the Targum Unkelos translates, what does it mean Vayikach Korach and Korach took? The Ispalag Korach, and Korach broke away. The Ispalag, he split. Korach split. This is an unusual Targum for the word Vayikach. If you look all over the Torah and you look for the word Vayikach, whenever it says Vayikach, the Targum translates Vinosiv. Vinosiv means to take. Over here, Vayikach Korach, the Targum doesn't translate that Korach took, but rather Korach broke away. The Ispilig Korach. Korach broke away. Korach caused a divide, a schism, a crack. He broke off from Moshe. He broke away from the Jewish people. In the Sfarim it says, the Noam Elimelech, the great holy Rebbe Elimelech Melezensk, makes an interesting parallel. And he says that the Targum translates the Ispeli Korach, the Targum is really telling us really the root and the origins of where this entire uprising of Korach comes from. Where does it come from? He says this is rooted in the first time there is a pilug, the first time there is a break and there is a separation. Where is there a pilug and where is there a separation? Where is there this a split in the universe? Where did it all begin? So the Noam Elimelech says, he directs us to the story of creation. The second day of creation. It says when Hashem created the world, on the first day he created light. But then it came to the second day. It says, Vayomer Elikim, that God said, Yehi Rokia. On Monday, God said, let there be a firmament. Vehi Mavdil, and it should separate Beimayim Lamayim, between waters and waters. Between the upper waters and the lower waters. On the second day, God created this Rokia, this firmament. And what is the firmament? The firmament is that which, this is the first time there is a break, there is a split in creation, there is a separation, there is a divisiveness. So the Noam Elimelech says that Vayikach Korach, that when Korach took and broke away from Moshe, Korach's, the origins of this breakaway is rooted in that split that Hashem was splitting between the upper waters and the lower. Now you'll wonder and you'll say, wait, there's already a division taking place on the first day, as it says that God divided and separated between light and darkness, but that's not really considered a machlokes, that's not quoted a division, because these are two opposite things. There's light and there's darkness, it just shouldn't be mixed together. But over here we're talking about water. There is just water. And then Hashem goes and he splits the water, and there is the higher water and the lower water. That split is already division. That's already two teams. That's already a machlokas. We know that that split is, it says that God did not, on the first day of a Monday, when Hashem did that, Monday was the only day when Hashem did not say Kitov. It says, why didn't Hashem say Kitov on Monday? Kitov means it's good at the completion of the day. Shaboy nevras ha-machlokas. Because on Monday, machlokas, divisiveness, discord, separation, division was created in the world, and therefore God did not say Kitov. Well, what do we know about Korach? What do we know about when we talk about Korach? What was he all about? Korach was a man of divisiveness. He brought about a fight. He caused it. If we're always, when the sages want to talk about Korach in terms of characterizing who he is, they call him a Baal Machlokas. He's a man of war. He's a man of fight. That's what he's all about. He instigates fighting. There is a pasuk in which it says that v'lo yiyah, this week in the parsha, it says v'lo yiyah k'korach u'kadoso, we should not be like Korach and like his party. And we learn out from here, kol ha-machzik b'machlokas. If anybody holds on to machlokas, they are violating this mitzvah of not being like Korach. So we have to always try to keep away as much as we can, God forbid, from causing any fights. And quite on the contrary, we have to be the Talmidim of Aaron. And what was Aaron? Aaron was Oiv Shalom, Verodiv Shalom. He always seeked and try to make peace. Korach is a man of machlokes. But why is Korach a man of machlokes? Because Korach is rooted in Monday. His origins are in Monday, and his origins is in that rakia, in that firmament that splits between the upper waters and lower, which caused the first machlokes. That's where he comes from. Interesting, when it speaks about the rakia in Yechezkel, in the Navi, it says Yechezkel sees the rakia, and he says, I saw a rakia ke'en ha-kerach. I saw a rakia, I see a firmament that looked like ice. And what's the word? Ke'en ha-kerach. And there you go, Korach. Korach is clearly rooted in that rakia, because the rakia is ke'en ha-kerach. That's Korach. But if that's the case, and it can't be that bad, Korach can't be that bad, because God did it. And God would not be doing a bad thing. God would only be doing a good thing. So before we get to that, just one more thought. Not only is Korach and Korach's rebellion against Moshe associated with, because he was a Baal Machlokes, associated with that split in the universe between the upper waters and the lower waters, but the content of the Machlokes is actually the same. Meaning not only the fight, the fighting itself, but what they were fighting about is also the same. What was the content of the Monday split? So the Zohar says in Bereshis, in Parshas Bereshis, actually in the Hakdama, it's not even in Parshas Bereshis, it's in the Hakdama, in the introduction to the Zohar, on Daf Yud Zayin. So the Zohar says over there that the idea of Korach, the idea of that split between the upper waters and the lower waters is the challenge from the left to the right. There is the right side, and the content of the split is that the left is challenging the right. And what does it mean that the left is challenging the right? On the first day, it was a day of chesed. Yom Rishon, the first day, we know every day of creation corresponds to another one of Hashem's midos. The first day is Yom Rishon, was a day of chesed. And therefore, on the first day, chesed is revelation, as we mentioned earlier. So on the first day of creation, we know that God was felt in the entire universe. All of existence was permeated with the oneness of Hashem. That's why it says, it doesn't say Yom Rishon, it doesn't say the first day, it says Yom Echad. Because the Achdus, the unity of God, was felt in all of existence, because every speck of the universe was expressing its creator, was expressing God. So there was Achdus in this world. Why? Because it's Sunday. Sunday is revelation. Hashem is revealed everywhere. Then comes Monday, and what happened on Monday? On Monday there is already separation, which means that really God is differentiating between heaven and earth. He's creating that barrier between the spiritual and the physical, and separating the upper waters from the lower waters. The second day is already a day where God is not felt within the lower worlds, and therefore what happens? We begin to feel duality, and we begin to feel the many and the like. So the second day is the introduction of Tzimtzum, the introduction of something to block God's unity, to block Hashem from being present and very strongly pronounced in the world. That's the power of Gevurah, because what does Gevurah do? Gevurah is restraining and holding back and not allowing the godly light and the godly influence to permeate and to reveal itself and to sweep through all of creation. So what do we see? That on Monday, the energy of Monday and the Rakia is the introduction of Gevurah, where Gevurah is now contradicting Chesed. Chesed is that universal perfection where all of the world is bathing in godly light, is encompassed in divinity and in godliness. Comes Monday, which now Hashem is introducing Midas HaGevurah, which says to God, hold back and don't reveal yourself to your creations. So this is the negation of Gevurah that contradicts the Chesed. But the Chesed wants to spill and reveal itself all over the world, but the Gevurah doesn't let it. So the smile, the left side, challenges the right side. Now let's take a look at Korach for a moment and see exactly that. Korach is a Levi. He comes from the world of the left. As we spoke earlier, that Levi is Gevurah. Aaron is the high priest, the champion of chesed and of kindness. And therefore, Korach is fighting against Aaron. This is the challenge of the left to the right. So it's not only that this is machlokas, but this is actually the same machlokas. This is creation replaying itself in this world? If so, so then why is Korach a negative thing? I mean, after all, creation is something that God did, and God, if Hashem would have wanted there should be only chesed, then he would have left the world in Sunday. If Hashem moved on to create and brought us into Monday, then obviously there is a purpose in Monday, and it needs to be, and it's a good thing. So if so, then Korach, which was just the manifestation of Gevurah, which comes after Chesed, so that's a good thing. So what is bad about Korach? So as mentioned earlier, true, whatever God does is good. Whatever God does is good. So it couldn't be that God is doing something bad. But yet, even though it can't be that God is doing something bad, we take a look at Monday, and the goodness of God's Monday creation is not obvious. The goodness is hidden. That's why on Monday there is an absence of the word Ki Tov. There is no Ki Tov on Monday, as we mentioned earlier. Why? Because this division and this machlokas and this assertion of the left to try to block the revelation of the right is considered not good, to the point that God couldn't say it's good. So even though God is doing it, but it's not good. We can't say on the Monday creation that it's good. That's why since that day, Mondays is always a very difficult day for people. Because Hashem doesn't say Ki Tov on Monday. And we think it's because we go back to work and the work week begins. But there's something intrinsic in Monday. Because Monday is the day that Hashem did not say Ki Tov. But then on the other hand, what do you mean? How can it be that God creates something that's not good? And the answer is, it is good. But the goodness is going to take a little time until it's going to reveal itself. The goodness of Monday will only be seen on Tuesday. That's why, because what happened on Tuesday? On Tuesday, Hashem continued to create. And what did he do on Tuesday? He said, Tuesday is the one day, Tuesday and Friday, 2 days in Hashem's creation, in which God proclaims two times Ki Tov. Why did Hashem say twice Tuesday Ki Tov? Because one was for his completion of what he did on Monday, and the other one was for the work of Tuesday. God did two things on Tuesday. The first thing that he did on Tuesday was he gathered the waters into one place. Because initially, after he separated the upper waters and the lower waters, the waters were still flooding the entire earth. So then Hashem took all the water and he put them into the sea and into the ocean, and he exposed dry land. That work of exposing dry land was considered the completion and the final touch to what he was really doing on Monday, which is called Meleches Hamayim, his work with the water. And when Hashem did that, he said Ki Tov. But he didn't say Ki Tov because what he did today, he already is saying Ki Tov on what he did yesterday. The entire work with the water, including the splitting the upper waters from the lower waters, are now, when it comes Tuesday, Hashem says Ki Tov, it's good. Then Hashem did something else on Tuesday, and he said, let the world become full of grass and trees. He brought forth the vegetation, the plants, the trees, and all that happened on Tuesday. And then Hashem said Ki Tov a second time. But what do we see from here? That the goodness of Monday, it's good, but it's a hidden good. And it's not, we cannot see it until Tuesday comes, which means Tuesday has to fix Monday. Monday on its own is a negative day, is not a positive day. Retroactively or retrospectively, when we come to Tuesday and we do what we need to do on Tuesday, then we can turn around and say, Monday is also good. And here is where Korach made a mistake. What Korach wanted, Korach did not want the goodness to be revealed on Tuesday. Korach said that Monday should be good just as being Monday. We don't need Tuesday to make Monday good. Let Monday be good Monday itself. Don't wait till Tuesday to have to discover the goodness of Monday. Now, Korach was not completely off the mark. When Moshiach is going to come, Monday is going to be the greatest day of the week. Isn't that exciting? Monday is going to be the day of Gevura. Monday is going to be an awesome day. Much, much, much greater than Sunday. Monday, now today's days, we love Sunday. But when Moshiach comes, Monday is going to be the day, and it's not going to need Tuesday to validate it and to justify it. However, in the world, but Korach's mistake was that can only be revealed. The power of Monday And the greatness of Monday is only going to be revealed in the future. Until Mashiach comes, the beauty of Monday or the goodness of Monday can only be revealed on Tuesday. So now let's try to get a little bit of a better understanding of this. What does this mean? What does it mean? What is it? Monday and what happens on Tuesday? And how does Tuesday make Monday good? And what exactly was done on Tuesday to make Monday good? So let's understand what's happening over here. Before we do that, what exactly happened on Tuesday? How does Tuesday make Monday good? What does Tuesday do to Monday to make it good? Well, let's take a look for a minute. Sunday, we said, is chesed, kindness, revelation. That's why God creates light. Light is revelation. Monday, God is holding back. He's creating a firmament, gevura, restriction, holding back, not allowing the light to flow. The light that's permeating the supernal worlds are not reaching the lower worlds. That's the idea of the separation between the Mayim Elyonim and the Mayim Tachtonim, as we're soon going to see, the separation of those two worlds. So gevura contradicts the chesed. What happens on Tuesday? How does Monday become a good day? How do we reveal the good of Monday? That is through the what Tuesday introduces. What does Tuesday introduce? Tuesday makes peace between Sunday and Monday. And how does Tuesday make peace between Sunday and Monday? By integrating them both, by making Monday be subservient to Sunday. Which means by making the gevura be subservient to the chesed. Tuesday brings it together. But the manner in which it brings it together is by telling Monday that it must be the weaker element and join along with Sunday. Sunday has to tolerate Monday. Monday needs to be superior or inferior to Sunday. That's how they merge together. Let's understand, what does this mean? Sunday has to be superior. What are we talking about? So let's, for one moment, let's take a look at these two midos. The midos ha-chesed and midos ha-gevura. What is Tuesday? Tuesday is the mid of rachamim. Rachamim means compassion. So we analyze these midos, we understand. Chesed means kindness. Now, and many times we confuse the two. Kindness means to give, to be giving and caring. And what does rachamim mean? Compassion. And compassion is also giving. When you feel empathy and when you feel compassionate or pity for someone, so then you give them. What is the difference between giving out of kindness and giving out of compassion? And the difference is like this. Giving out of kindness is, from the perspective of kindness, kindness sees virtue and it sees goodness in everybody and in everything. Kindness is incapable of seeing bad. There aren't people that way. They have such good eyes. They, no matter in the worst situation, they always see the silver lining. They always see the goodness. They see the in the most evil of person, they can find something nice and something good. Avram Avinu was a kind man. And Avram Avinu felt that everybody should get. And even the worst person in Avram's mind, well, he's still a creation of God. If he's a creation of God, then isn't that make him worthy to receive that I should give him a nice hot lunch? Avram was giving to everybody. He saw the good in all of God's creation. Gevura is the exact opposite. Gevura can see fault. Like it says by God, it says, Gam b'malach av yasim tehila. Even in the perfect angels that are so perfect, God finds some kind of imperfection. Gevura is very, very judgmental. And nothing is perfect. It has one of those discriminating, judgmental, the force of judgment. And God's gvura is the judgment into its infinite, which means that the best of the best is still undeserving because it's still not perfect. There's something missing. So chesed says to give because you deserve. Gvura says don't give because you don't deserve. And then what does rachamim say? What is compassion? Compassion also says to give. It says to give, but it's a whole different kind of giving. Because compassion harmonizes the chesed and the gevura together and tilts it towards chesed. What does that mean, that it's harmonizing the chesed and gevura and tilts it towards chesed? It means something like this. Compassion doesn't say that the person deserves, like chesed says. Compassion says, I acknowledge they don't deserve. They have this and this and this and this problem, and therefore they don't deserve. But you know what? It's a rachmanis. It's a pitiful state. You're not going to give them. They're hungry. They need help. It's a rachmanis. So, you know, you have a cousin who was thrown out of their home. Why were they thrown out of their home? Because their parents have said, listen here, this child, this person is just a good for nothing. They're a spoiled brat sitting at home and not doing anything with their life. And the child has to learn. So the parents went and throw the child out of the house. But you know your cousin, you're a kind person, and this is your cousin, and you know, you like this child for whatever reason. And you see certain nice things about them, you take this child in. You're not going to leave the child out. Take the child in. And the child sits by you a month. After a month, you're already beginning to think like the parents. You realize that this child is really a spoiled brat. So here what's happening is, well, you once had your kindness to this person is now challenged by the Gevurah, because the Gevurah says that what? That, you know, you got to throw this person. That is indeed, whatever the parents did, the child really is not deserving of this kindness. So you throw the child out of the home. Wait, out of here. But then a few days later, the child comes back, and they're bleeding, and they were, so then you look and you feel terrible. What do you feel terrible? It's a rachmanis, Meaning, it's not that I now say that you do deserve, I recognize you don't deserve, but it's still a rachmanis. Rachmanis meaning I have pity, which means that the way it's making peace is by making the kindness acknowledge the gevurah. Because kindness is saying you deserve, and the gevurah says it doesn't deserve, and the two are in conflict with each other. So this is saying that, no, I acknowledge, and I recognize, and I accept the non-deserving of what the gevurah says, but yet let the kindness dominate, and that we should give and not hold back. So the rachamim is incorporating the gevurah and yet extending and giving. So comes out that Tuesday, which is a day of rachamim, what is it doing? It's bringing together Sunday and Monday, the kindness and the gevurah, and it's keeping the chesed, which means the final decision is to give, not to give. This is the reason why, back to Korach and Aaron, in today's world, the way we have, when we have these two dynamic energies, the energies of Kahuna, and then we have the energy of the Levites, how does the Torah is Teferis. The Torah was given on the third millennium because the Torah is the Teferis. How does the Torah reconcile the two energies of Kohanim and Levium? What does it do? It brings them together, but it stations the Levites as the support team of the Kohanim. They're here and they need to be supportive of the Kahuna. Which means the kahuna, which is what rachamim does, what compassion does, it brings the two together and it keeps the chesed above the gevurah, right? Korach, on the other hand, as we mentioned earlier, did not want to administer that which Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, that we need to have the rachamim and you need to have the chesed dominating the gevurah. Korach felt that gevurah should stand on its own right and it should not be subservient to the chesed. So now we need to understand what was Korach's belief. I mean, what exactly was he, was he standing for? And what was, and why? We say Mashiach is going to be that way. What does it mean when Mashiach is going to be that way? How can it be that way when Mashiach comes? What is going to change when Mashiach comes from what the way it is now? So we have to go back into Monday and understand what happened on Monday. We said earlier that God went and he separated between the upper waters and the lower waters. Bemayim alyonim, lamayim tachtonim, between the upper worlds and upper waters and the lower waters. What is the inner meaning of that separation? What really took place? What was God separating on? So the Kabbalists tell us like this. They tell us that water is pleasure. Pleasure. Water is pleasure. Why is water pleasure? Because water makes all pleasurable things grow. I might say that's a far cry, you know, that's far-fetched. Because water, there's a lot of other pleasurable things in the world besides plants, fruits. But if we think about when God initially created the world, what's the place of pleasure? If we're looking for where is pleasure going to be experienced, pleasure was going to be experienced in the Gan. The Gan is a place of pleasure. Gan Eden. That's a place. And what is in Gan Eden? Gan Eden is a garden. A garden with all kinds of delightful things that are here to give pleasure to a person. Now, what keeps the Gan in operation? What? The Gan is growing. The trees, the plants, the fruits. Where is it coming from? It's coming from the water. Which means the water is the source of all pleasure. So water is pleasure. Now we have this water, this great body of water, which means the entire realm of pleasure. And Hashem puts a rakia, Hashem puts a firmament, and he separates between upper pleasures and lower pleasure. What does it mean? What was God doing when he created, And he created, the result of that was Mayim Elyonim, there is the upper waters, and then there is Mayim Tachtonim, there is lower waters. We understand. The upper waters means spiritual pleasure. Pleasure associated with God. Pleasure as it is experienced in the upper worlds. And we know that kind of pleasure. Sometimes we're studying Torah and we get tremendous pleasure from what we learned. Sometimes we have pleasure in doing a mitzvah. That's a holy form of pleasure. Prayer can be very pleasurable. You have a deep moment of connection to God, and when your soul has an intimate moment with Hashem, it's very, very pleasurable. So we know that there is such a thing called spiritual pleasure. In the higher worlds, it's all about the experiences of pleasure. That's what Gan Eden is all about. And that's what all souls are doing after they leave this world, after they have a little cleansing periods. Neshamas go on into Gan Eden, in which they are continuously experiencing pleasure after pleasure after pleasure. But all the pleasure that there is in the spiritual world are all connected to pleasure in God. Godly pleasure. And then there is the other kind of pleasure, which is physical pleasure. What's the physical pleasure? Well, the pleasures that there are on earth. Earthy pleasure, the pleasure that there is in food, the pleasure that there is in music, the pleasure that there are in visual arts, the pleasure that there is in all the other experiences in life. There's so many different kinds of pleasures in this world, but those pleasures are physical, meaning they're not connected to God. Now, to get a little bit of a deeper understanding of the huge impact of what happened when God separated from the upper pleasure and the lower pleasure, and that is like this. In truth, there is only one pleasure. And the pleasure is the pleasure in knowing Hashem, the pleasure in experiencing God, that's pleasure. God is pleasurable. And therefore, anybody that has any kind of a connection to Him and an experience of the divine is experiencing immense pleasure. How does pleasure increase in the higher worlds? The greater, the more expansive the experience is. So that's why it says in all the writings when it describes what Gan Eden is, it's a world in which souls are getting knowledge and understanding in God, and the higher and the deeper they understand, the greater is their pleasure. As the neshamas move higher in Gan Eden to higher knowing of Hashem. Pleasure can only be when you're touching and when you're connecting to the true existence that is the source of all existence. So in the upper worlds, there's no such a thing as any other pleasure. And that's why all the creations in the upper world are only pursuing one thing. It's a pursuit of Hashem, because pleasure can only be related to God. When God went and He made the firmament, God created a very strange possibility. Even though He is pleasure, He is the root, I mean, from Him comes pleasure, and there is no other true pleasure other than Him, He took crumbs or tidbits or part of His pleasure, and He threw it and He disconnected it from Him. Which means He incarnated those powers of pleasure in physical things. Now, again, the pleasure that there is in anything in the world really is the pleasure of Hashem. It's a little spark of God's energy that's within this object, in this food, in this experience that's giving pleasure. However, that's not the way it appears, that's not the way we experience it. When we experience food, for instance, we're experiencing pleasure of food without any knowledge and without any recognition that the tingling and sensations that I'm experiencing right now is my pleasure of God. I don't know that. I just feel the food and I feel myself, but I'm not feeling Hashem at all. And the same is in all the other pleasures in which we do. Which is really completely ridiculous, because again, the pleasure of everything is really just the pleasure of the divine, but it's all hidden, it's all disconnected. And that is what happened when Hashem split the upper waters from the lower water. He cast it down, and He threw it, and He separated from Him. So it's disconnected from the divine. What happens to the water? When the water came down low, the water is crying. And it says that on the second day, the lower waters are crying. And what are they crying? They're saying, Anon be'inon l'meheva kamamalkam. We want to be in front of the king. Which means the lower waters themselves, the physical, the pleasure that there is in physicality within the world, it in its own, within itself, recognizes how false it is, how impossible it is, how ridiculous it is to experience pleasure disconnected and unassociated with God, how unreal that is. So the pleasure wants to go back to being truthful, to being what it really is, to being connected to Hashem. So the very physical things that give pleasure in this world are discontent and unhappy with their lot of who they are in this pretending and this illusion that which they create for us to feel and think that we can have some other experience and sensation of pleasure that is not related to the divine. They're uncomfortable with it to the point that they're weeping. Pleasure itself is weeping. And I was just thinking about this. That's probably the reason why we all see that all physical pleasure is far more enticing and promising before we have it than after we have it. It's a very strange thing. We're always pursuing pleasurable experiences. We want this and we want that. And we create in our minds such excitement about the pleasure we're going to have. We go and we indulge in that pleasure, and then what? Just an emptiness. Just a void. I mean, this happens to me every time. I love getting away from the city. I want to go away. I want to go on vacation. I want to go here. I want to go see the mountains and see the trees. And there's nice things. And I go and I do this. And it's so magnificent in my mind before I do it. And then I come back and there's always like, Anybody ever went on a vacation and came back? And it was really good. It's not that you didn't. You had fine gourmet meals, and you saw the nicest things, and you toured nice cities, and you saw when you went on a cruise, and you came here, and you went there, you did that. So what happens a week later? You had it all. You were there everywhere. You had this experience and that experience. Why? The weeping waters. It's a distortion. It does not live up to what it is promising. I'm not saying there isn't a thrill and an enjoyment while it's happening, but it leaves us empty because the lower waters are disconnected. They're not real. Pleasure is only in the divine. So you got to ask the question, why did God do this? Why does he make us meshuggah? Why does he create these lower waters And make mankind go nuts with pleasure? All their life, running around pleasure from empty experience to an empty experience to empty experience to after empty experience. What's the point of it? And the answer is, the lower waters are crying, we want to go up, and the human being that pursues pleasure and gets fooled again and again and again and again. How many times can we buy into the same stupidity and the same false promise? After a while, the soul gets so fed up because you're looking for something of substance, you're looking for something real, and it's trying to get it here, and you're trying to get it there, and it keeps on promising sensation and happiness, but there is no happiness. So what happens? The soul too begins to cry for a relationship with God. And that's why we have story after story of people that really, really had it all. And they've had all the pleasures the world has to offer and been famous and hung out with all the stars and had all the craziest parties that there are and traveled the world and seen it all. And yet, if they're Jewish especially, there is some hunger in their soul that they can't explain, where they're just looking for truth. They're looking for something. I'm looking, I'm looking, I'm looking. So why did God create the lower waters? So that the lower waters should weep and it should cry and should say, I want to come back in front of the king. In order that we should really, really know with absolute certainty, without a doubt, that there is no reality and there's no satisfaction and there is no truth and there's no fulfillment aside from the knowledge of God and the connection to God. We have to taste all these other false promises. And where do they lead us? They lead us back to Hashem. And then our appetite for God is so intense and so great because of the lack, because of the absence of truth that the lower waters present. And therefore, what exactly is then the ultimate destiny of the lower waters? The lower waters are supposed to lead us back to the upper waters. They're supposed to be leading the person back to a journey to searching for real pleasure and the pleasure. And when the lower waters lead us to that, then the lower waters themselves, the physical pleasures that we have when a person does what we call tshuva, and we're turning back to Hashem and looking for our pleasure in a place that's real, in a place that's true, and that is in Torah and in the mitzvahs and in a connection to God, then all the misleading pleasures that we had become part of that elevation, and all the lower waters are now elevated back to the higher waters. So it's actually the rejection of the lower waters which actually elevates the lower waters. Kind of interesting. So now, that's why it says that God appeased the lower waters. How did Hashem appease the lower waters? When the lower waters were crying, Hashem said to the lower waters, you know, with every, that in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, they're gonna bring you back to me. You're crying, you're going to be elevated. Because when they bring a korban, which is a sacrifice, they're going to take an animal, and with every animal, you have to offer, you have to put a little salt. And where does salt come from? Salt comes from the water. So the water is going to be elevated. And also, on Sukkot, they're going to spill the libations, the nesachim, and they're going to spill water at least once a year. And that is going to be the elevation of the lower waters. What God is essentially saying, that mankind is going to discover the secret, that physical pleasure is only here to lead us to spiritual pleasure. That physicality is only an instrument and a tool to bring us closer to Hashem, which means that man is going to elevate the lower waters and connect it to God. Now we'll understand the significance of how Tuesday fixes Monday. We said earlier, Monday isn't good, but Tuesday will fix Monday. Because what happened on Tuesday? Hashem separated and created Monday. God separated the spiritual pleasure from the lower pleasure. But now Hashem says, how is this going to be fixed? I can't say it's good, because in its present condition of deception, it's not good. The only way it's going to be good is if we can reconnect the lower waters to the higher waters. When is that going to happen? So when the human being is going to come, and the human being with his knowledge and his understanding is going to recognize the falseness of the lower waters, and he's going to take the lower waters and reconnect them to the higher waters. That's why it's fixed on Tuesday, because what happened on Tuesday? God made space for the human beings to live. God exposed dry land. Humans can't live in the ocean. Hashem poured the waters into the sea. Now there is the revelation or the expose of dry land. Here is where human beings are going to pop. Here is where the population of the human being is going to be. And the human being and the Jewish people and those who are pursuing God are going to elevate the lower waters and reconnect unto Hashem. And that is the appeasement to the lower waters. Comes out like this, that the answer to the Monday split between the dichotomy that exists between the spiritual and the physical, it's all solved by what? By the raising of physicality and bringing it back to the spiritual. What does that mean? It means by not negating one, you're bringing them together, but what did we say earlier? The gevura has to be subservient to the chesed. What does that mean? Chesed is spirituality, because chesed is a world where godliness is revealed. Gevura is the source of the physical, because gevura means where God is contracting and hiding and creating an entity that is ungodly, disconnected from Him. The way we fix this gevura world and the consequential disconnected physical realm is if the physical is supporting the spiritual. When the physical is a means and an instrument, it's not worshipped as a thing unto its own, but the physical is only a means in which for us to serve our Creator or us to connect to Hashem in the spiritual, which we use the physical. Now, in brief, as it relates to us as individuals, we have within our lives two realms. We have the spiritual, our spiritual part, and that is what we would call the life of our neshama, the life of our soul, and everything that our neshama drives us to do. What does our soul drive us to do? To be connected to Hashem through what? Through studying Torah, through doing mitzvahs. So when we're studying Torah, we're doing something that our soul has an interest in. When we're doing a mitzvah, even though we're doing it with our body, but we're really doing something that is motivated by our neshama. When we are praying, we are turning to God. This is our life of our neshama. So really we can say in our own life, that's our mayim elyonim. That's our spiritual realm. That's our supernal waters. Then we all have big chunks of life in which we are engaged in material and physical things, mundane elements of our life. The things that we do that are not directly related to God, to mitzvahs, to holiness. And that is what we're doing actually most of our days, most of our time, the way God set it up for most people, besides some people that are lucky that they can indulge themselves in spirituality most of their time, 90% of their time. For most people, it's the opposite. 90% of their time, they are involved in physical, mundane things. It includes eating, shopping, cooking, taking care of our home, earning a living, livelihood, everything that we do. And that is mundanity, meaning it's things that are, if we don't make an effort, they are godless. They have no connection to Hashem. What is our, and that's called our lower waters. There's the Mayim Tachtum, the physical realm of our life, and there's the spiritual. The way we fix this, these two parts, or the way we bring them together again, is we are taught, Kol Masecha Yi L'Shem Shamayim. When we take the physical elements of our life, and we are using them as means of helping support the Torah mitzvah part of our life. For instance, simple it means, if I'm going to have a lot of guests on Shabbos, I'm going to have a nice, beautiful Shabbos meal, so I need to have the money in order to be able to do that. I need to work, and I need to cook on Friday, and do all that shopping and all that work that I'm doing. So even though it's a physical activity, but it's all with the intention of being able to have a Shabbat meal, and with a time where we'll sing to God, and we'll inspire people, and just have an amazing connection to Hashem. So that means that all that physical work is just supporting this spiritual experience. Or a person going out, you work, and you can maybe work a little less, but you're choosing to work a little more because you want to make a comfortable living. And the intention of making a comfortable living is you can send your children to free school, in which they will go to public school, in which they're not going to have a Jewish education. But if you want to send them to a good Jewish school, it's going to have a few children, it's going to cost you $20,000, $30,000, whatever. So you need to work harder. So even though you're spending so much time, you have a godly intention in doing it in order that your children should have a Jewish education. You want to connect them to Hashem, that's why you're doing it. Or you know that if you're going to have bills to pay and you have an eviction notice to leave your home, or the mortgage is the house is being going into foreclosure, you are not going to have a head. You're not going to have a clear mind. We are not going to have a clear mind to be able to study Torah. So therefore, I want to make sure that I have a comfortable living so that I can study Torah. So even though I am spending 90% of my life doing things that are not directly related to God, all those things have a godly intention. They're all supporting the 10% when I am studying, when I am praying, when I'm educating my children, or doing the good. It might be only a small part, but everything that I'm doing, it's with that intention. So all these things are supporting those 10%, and they're elevated. Not only is it supporting, but it's actually increasing it. Because the person who cannot be in shul all day and studying and learning is thirstier for godliness because he's missed it, because he's been wandering in this emptiness for so much of my life. I'm sitting and doing things that I see have no real content to them. So therefore I feel empty, and I feel my soul is yearning. So when I do come to shul, or when I do study, it's with an extra. I wait for Shabbos. I wait for, not just so I can take a long nap. I'm waiting for Shabbos, because Shabbos I'll be able to dedicate a little bit more time to my neshama and to my soul, and to cultivate my relationship with God. So actually the involvement of 90% of my time in the mundane and in the unholy is actually increasing my appreciation and my love and my thirst for those small percent of time. So the lower waters are weeping, and they're being fulfilled because they're creating within the person that weeping and that crying, I want to be in front of the King, in which we cherish that little bit of time in which we're connected to Hashem. That is the elevation of the lower waters as it is from the Tuesday in today's world as we know it today. Where Tuesday rectifies Monday. And Monday is only justified, which means a separation from God is only justified in as much as it's going to later increase an attachment to Hashem. So that is the way things are today. But then there is a messianic world, which is much deeper, much deeper. Where physicality doesn't need to be sublimated by spirituality in order for physicality to be true, real, and a connection to Hashem. Where physicality enjoys its own connection to God. Where Monday stands on its own right without needing Tuesday. What does that mean? How can physicality be something of holiness on its own? The answer to that is we discussed a few weeks ago when we spoke about the ultimate state of the Jewish people that we're going to live in is going to be by the resurrection of the dead, by Tchiyas HaMeisim. And what did we say is going to happen by Tchiyas HaMeisim? The body is going to be resurrected. And in that class we discussed, which we can't go over now, is that the physical has something to say about God that that the spiritual realms don't know. And our discussion that we had then, the idea was that physical, again, what is the difference between spiritual and physical, just in short? Spiritual is something that always speaks of a source. Spirituality is always serving something higher than itself. So for instance, when I see somebody doing something spiritual, when you're learning Torah, what are you doing? I'm engaged in God's knowledge. You see someone is serving someone. When I'm praying, what am I doing? I'm talking to God. When I'm doing a mitzvah, I'm serving something. When you meet someone eating, someone shopping, so what are you doing? That's drawing attention to yourself. Physicality is self-centered. Spirituality is selfless, in a sense. It's here recognizing a source, subservient to its source. Now, here's an amazing thing. The very physical that is so self-centered, really, 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 the core of its self-centeredness is because the physical is an expression of the one who has a true and real and absolute self, and that is God. See, everything in the world is unjustified if it claims I am, because everything in the world has no I. God is making it to be. So all of existence has a something which is the cause of it. God is the only one that doesn't have a cause. He is because he is. Now there is no other creature and no other being and no other substance in the world that has that feeling that I am because I am and there's no source to me other than the physical. Because physicality gives off that feeling. I exist because I exist. What really is then the physical really all about? One day God is going to be able to give us a little taste of who he really is, of God's truth, not God's emanations, not God's revelations, but God's real, real truth. God is going to use the physical as a spigot, as an instrument through which he can express his essence, because the physical is the only one who understands existence without a source. That's what we discussed a few weeks ago. And that's why one day, the physical, its very self-centeredness and its very selfish feeling of self is going to be speaking of the divine in a manner that the spiritual doesn't know, because all of spirituality only knows something with a source. They don't understand something that is sourceless. Physicality knows that. But here's the thing. It comes out that the very blockage of why physical is so dense and not godly, which is, as we said earlier, that's the power of Gevura. Chesed is where everything feels where it's coming from, because God is revealed to his creations. What is Gevura? Gevura is Hashem hiding. The hiding of God, what is that really intending? It's not really meant to be bringing us to the absence of Hashem. Really, the Gevura is here. The absence of God is really here to be able to show us an existence that's existence is absolute, like Hashem is, where the physical is really just an expression of the divine essence. So Korach was saying that what? Korach was saying that I don't want to have to take the physical world and bend it and yield it towards spirituality to make my every physical endeavor have a intention that I'm doing it for something spiritual. Instead, why can't we just discover God in the physical things we do without looking for a spiritual justification for it? Why do I have to eat in order that I should be able to do a mitzvah? Why can't I just eat and enjoy the eating as the sake of eating? You'll say that's godless? No, doesn't have to be that way. There is another method of serving Hashem in the physical, which is called Bechol Derachecha De'ehu. In all your ways you should know him. What does it mean to know God in all your ways? Doesn't mean Kol Masecha Yiyeh L'Shem Shamayim. Kol Masecha Yiyeh L'Shem Shamayim, the ordinary dealing with the physical is when we're taking physicality and we're using it to do something spiritual, which means we're dismissing it. We're not really involved in it for its own sake. I am eating, so I should have power to serve you, God. But I'm not into the experience of the eating itself. But there is another meaning. Know God in that which you're doing. What does it mean to know God with what you're doing? If I'll give an example, a businessman, instead of having to always look for the money that I'm going to earn from my business, and then I'm going to use that money to be able to do a mitzvah, no. How about the experience of doing business itself, in which a businessman is able to see divine providence every moment? When you're doing business, you can see how God is orchestrating all kinds of things. And that's true. And when someone is not involved in materialism, material physical things, you don't get to see that. Because only the businessman can see how so many things are happening, which you didn't, and you happen to be here, and you got the late 5 minutes, and you met this one, you make that one, and you see. Oh, but here's the thing. It's very tricky to be able to see God. See, to be able to see God in physicality itself, that usually doesn't happen. Usually what happens when we get involved in the physical is that the physical world blocks God. And we begin to think that we're the success. I did this and I'm so smart and I called this guy and I called that guy. So usually that's what happens with our minds because physical blocks Hashem. We have a moment. Every business will say, oh, today I had such hashgacha pratis. But it's only a moment. To be able to go to work and the entire experience at work should be one lesson of seeing God operating in his magnificent way, how God is moving all the pieces of the world. To be able to see that constantly in your work, b'chol derechecha dayeyu, that's phenomenal. Most people won't do that. How about eating food? And in every bite you take, you say, wow, this is pleasure. God is so tasty. How can one being express itself in so many different tastes? Here is a tangy taste of God, and here is a sweetness of Hashem. How sweet must God be if this is just a tiny bit of his sweetness? How pleasurable must Hashem be? But here's the thing. You see how we can experience God in the pleasure we do? But that, is that likely that is going to happen? If a person says, you know, forget about me having kavana to serve Hashem. Let me experience the pleasures of the physical and in them be sharply aware that this is Hashem in everything that I am doing. This is God's beauty. I see art. I see this is God's beauty. I see this human being. I don't see the human being for their talent. I see the godly talent that's coming through this human being. And I'm reminded of Hashem in everything that I see and everything that I do. That's the ultimate. The physical has something to show about God that's so deep. But here's the thing. It's not likely that that's going to happen. What is going to happen when we get into physicality? Most of the time, to most of us, the physicality draws us away from God, not closer to God. Therefore, today's days until Mashiach comes, the first job that we need to do is we need to connect the lower waters to the upper waters. What does that mean? We need to take physical activities and not do them for their sake. Not even for the sake of finding God in them, because you can't find God in physical things that easy, because physical is a blockage. Instead, what do we need to do today? We have to take all physicality and use it as an instrument to get to the spiritual. We have to raise the lower waters to the upper waters. We need Tuesday to validate Monday. The Levium are only justified if the Levium are subservient to the Kohanim. That's today's world. When we do that, when we deny the body, and don't give the body the pleasure. Doesn't mean we shut down the body. We engage the body. But everything that we do with our body is that the body should serve the soul and support the soul. Then we refine the body. We refine it and we refine it and we refine it. And finally, when Mashiach comes, then not only is the body going to be integrated in the neshama, but something much deeper is going to happen. The body itself is going to begin teaching the soul that which the soul can never know. Because the body has now become so selfless and become an expression of God. Through its selfishness. But its selfishness then is not going to be coarse. Its selfishness is going to be the most sublime selfishness, meaning the sublime ability to express God in it being itself. In the body being so self, it's going to express the self of Hashem. But that's only if the body isn't coarse. And how do you make the body uncoarse? By making the body subservient to the soul during the time until Mashiach comes. Then when soul and body come back, body is going to reveal what the soul can't reveal. And Gevura is going to reassert itself to be higher than Chesed. And that was Korach's mistake. Korach thought we can go directly to a time of Bechol Derechecha De'ehu. We don't have to have Kol Ma'asecha Yihyeh L'Shem Shamayim as an introduction, and then eventually come to know God in all of our physical experience. If he said, if spiritual is God's creation, the physical is also God's creation. So why do you only seek to know God in the spiritual and use the physical as a support to the spiritual? Engage the spiritual on its own. Know that, involve yourself in physicality itself. That was his mistake. The lower waters until Mashiach comes need to be elevated by Tuesday. When Mashiach comes, Monday is going to come out of its darkness. And we're going to celebrate Monday for being Monday. We're going to, physical world is going to be as holy as the spiritual without needing to be a servant of the spiritual. The Levites are going to be higher than Kohanim, and our bodies are going to be much higher than our soul. May we merit to see that now. Just a hand right high.